everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And my name is John Moores. I'm a space engineering professor at York University and a planetary atmosphere specialist and also a speculative fiction nerd. So today, we've got a really interesting one. We talked in the last episode about what influence science advisors have on how the science in a film ends up. And so we thought it's only fair, having critiqued other science advisors, that this time around, we take the hit. Or specifically me, because we've got a movie today that I was a science advisor for. So everything in this one that's wrong, the whole science gripe section, it's all my fault. Just remember that. All right, so the movie is Clara. And what Clara does is it tells the story of a down-on-his-luck astronomer desperate to make a big breakthrough. He's recently divorced, and he's fired from his job. And then he puts his hopes in the planet-finding abilities of a new generation of space telescopes to give meaning to his existence. With the help of a mysterious artist, he succeeds in making a momentous discovery and gets a little bit of closure along the way.
The Drake equation gives us every reason to believe that life should be common in our galaxy. It's exciting, right? So why haven't we found anything? There's over 100 billion stars in the Milky Way, vast majority of which host planets, many of those planets capable of supporting life, and still we have found nothing. No sign of anyone or anything else. And believe me, we're looking.
So, let's start with the science gripes, like we always do. So Catherine, you had thoughts. Let me turn it over to you to start us off.
Right. So I had never seen this movie before. John, I think, was very much involved with the development. I think it was developed in 2017 and then it came out in 2018. Is that correct?
That's right. I think it might have started a little earlier than that in 2016, if I go back in my memory. Mm. It's a bit of a process.
So yeah, this was all new to me. It's a bit of a artistic movie, I guess I'll say. It was premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival. That's correct. Yeah.
That's right. I don't think it actually ran in theaters at all. According to Box Office Mojo, it does have a theater take in, I think, Romania, but no other country.
Okay. Well, if anyone's interested in watching this movie, because I'm guessing no one here except the two of us has seen it, you can find it for free on YouTube. So if you're wondering what we're talking about and you want to give it a look, you can find the full movie on YouTube. So I just watched it this weekend. I had never seen it before. And I'll give John credit. The science was pretty good. Although, as we'll get to later, I didn't love the movie as a whole. So the movie centers around this character, Isaac Bruno, which John informs me was taken from the names of two famous scientists, Isaac Newton and Giordano Bruno. And he is a postdoc at the fictional Ontario University, which this was clearly filmed in Toronto. I think they actually filmed it on the campus of, what was the University of Toronto, one of their sub-campuses. Which one was it, John?
Yeah, I think it's University of Toronto, Mississauga.
Ah, okay. So it was very clearly set in Toronto, in this sort of University of Toronto kind of mock university. So Isaac Bruno is a postdoc there, and yet he's somehow teaching a class. And this seems to be a big part of his job. The movie actually opens with him very unenthusiastically teaching a class on, I don't know, astronomy, I'm guessing. They go very quickly from the Drake equation into talking about their love lives, which is completely inappropriate for a classroom setting. But it's also extremely rare for a postdoc to teach a class. You do occasionally see it happen, especially for people who are interested in getting into teaching later on in their career. But for the most part, postdocs are paid to do research full time. That's their job. And honestly, that's what people care about when you're looking for a faculty job. They want to see a highly developed researcher. Teaching is always sort of the secondary consideration, which is unfortunate. I mean, we do need better teachers as professors, but that's just sort of how it is. So that was kind of a weird opening to this movie. I assumed he was a professor, but it became very clear later on that he was not. And then he's very quickly let go of his job, which is also somewhat unusual. Typically, you have a contract and you fulfill that contract. It's kind of tricky to get fired at an academic institution if you haven't fulfilled your contract. So
it's kind of weird that it's the department chair that does this. And there's this idea that he has an advisor that's sort of hinted around, but that advisor doesn't seem to be very important. And you're right. It's not like talking about the Drake equation in the way that he does is not advisable in the classroom setting, but probably a difficult way to get fired, I would think, in there.
Well, I think the reason he got fired was not the discussion of love life in the classroom, which is also very inappropriate, but I think he was misappropriating telescope time is the read I took on this. So he's desperate to find planets around other stars, exoplanets. And to do this, he's looking for planetary transits. So the little tiny dip in the light curve of a star that you get when a dark planet passes in front of it. That's not what he's supposed to be doing, is my understanding. I think he's been hired on to study the galactic center or something like that. But he keeps like trying to reposition the telescope to look for exoplanets instead. And so he gets in trouble for that.
Which is, of course, not something that really happens. It's not like you call up the observatory and they move around the telescope for you. No matter how nicely you comment on how their day is.
Yeah, I didn't like that point either. Not only is he just misappropriating telescope time, at one point he just directly calls the telescope up and his new friend Clara speaks to the operator in Spanish and manages to convince them to move the telescope, which is not how these things work. You know, telescope time is strictly scheduled, you know, months in advance. You have to apply to gain access to these telescopes, unless it was some really underutilized telescope, but it didn't sound like that was the case here. You know, I'm guessing they never actually specified which telescope he was using, other than it was a remote robotic telescope in Chile. But there are some very impressive telescopes in Chile that you can't simply call up and ask to move it to your target of interest.
Yeah, it's true. There are definitely some ones operated by amateurs out there, but those ones are completely unstaffed. And if we're talking about like the European Southern Observatory, I mean, the competition for that is fierce. Everything is super planned. But I think the only telescope that's mentioned by name in the film is the Keck telescopes, which are on the big island of Hawaii on Mauna Kea.
Right. At one point, he reaches out to his ex-wife, who's now working at Caltech. And I think Caltech does operate the Keck telescopes in some capacity. Is that right, John?
I'm not entirely sure about that. The Keck Foundation is pretty big, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's some relationship there.
Yeah, I think there is. So he asks her if he can get access to the Keck telescope to do some follow-up observations on one of the planets he thinks he's found. But this part kind of confused me as well, because he already has a transit. So a transit is just, again, that little dip in a star's light curve that you get when a planet passes in front of a star. That tells you how big the planet is, but it doesn't tell you how massive it is. Mm. And so I thought he was going to want to use Keck to find the mass of the planet, because with the mass and the size, you can get the density and learn something about the composition of a planet. And it sounds like Keck is often used for this purpose. It's called the radial velocity method. You look for tiny little wiggles in the movement of a star where it's being pulled on by a planet that's orbiting it. And so I figured that's what he was going down there to do. But when you see him in the Keck operating room, he's just looking at another transit. So that seemed a bit strange to me. If we put aside also the fact that he can instantly get telescope time just because his ex-wife asked for it.
Well, it is kind of interesting, I think. With Keck, you're right. I mean, it probably could be used to do a transit. It's a light gathering instrument. It does have, you know, instruments on board that you could train on a star and get a transit curve out of. But the spectrometers are the main attraction, right? And so you could do radial velocity with that. And in theory, you know, if the wavelengths are right, you could also get the different transit depths at different colors if you really wanted to. But the RV is the big thing there. So it's interesting, but I suppose part of the attraction for the filmmakers is that Keck might be on the verge of being known to other people. Like they might have faintly heard some of that, maybe some of the people closer to the field, whereas a lot of the other telescopes, I don't think I would know the names.
True. But they do make a big point of calling out the TESS telescope, which is also probably a telescope a lot of people have never heard of. TESS is a follow-up in some ways to the original Kepler mission, which launched in 2009, and it just stared at this patch of the sky for years, looking for transits around as many stars as it could. But many of them were very far away, and so it was hard to do follow-up surveys to determine their mass and some of their properties. So TESS followed up Kepler to specifically focus on nearby stars that were bright and could be well characterized later by telescopes on Earth like Keck that could do some you know, determine their mass, or JWST, which can determine their atmospheric composition. So again, TESS is well known to astronomers, but probably not well known to the general public. And it was, you know, the main focus of this movie.
And I know what was a major, you know, gripe of yours, Catherine, and me too. I don't blame the film for this, because, you know, astronomers are guilty of this as well, and love to put it in press releases. But the, you know, the question of what's the temperature of a planet that you find if you've got your transit and you've got your radial velocity.
Right. So they make this big point. Oh, they have the size and the mass and the density of this planet, and they know its temperature, and that a transit method could somehow tell you the temperature. But that's not true, because to know the temperature, you also have to know something about the composition and pressure of the atmosphere, which is very, very difficult thing to do for exoplanets. So we can have a range, right? If we assume different types of atmospheres, you can kind of get a range of temperature, but you can't know it, what it is for sure. And this is why this so-called habitable zone, this region around a star where liquid water is present at the surface, has a range. It's not just one distance. There's a range of distances, because, you know, different atmospheres will give you different temperatures. So the fact that they were so confident about the temperature really bothered me, because, you know, look even at our own planetary system, right? The Earth has a surface temperature of around 280 Kelvin, you know, a little bit above the freezing point of water. Yay, liquid water on the surface. But then we've got the moon right next door. No atmosphere. Temperatures there are terrible. You know, that is not a habitable environment, right? So atmospheric composition, atmospheric pressure is so important in determining the temperature and whether a planet is habitable. And they kind of just glossed over all of that.
Definitely. Although this is, like I say, a point where I think I blame the community more than I blame the filmmakers, because I know that when you put out press releases about these things, especially during the 2000s and the early 2010s, which is the period that I think they were looking at here, that it's often true that either the people preparing the press release or the press themselves will ask, oh, what is it like on this planet? And then the equilibrium temperature, assuming a reflectivity and albedo, essentially shows up. Even with the Earth, you're 100% right. The atmosphere makes a lot of difference. The moon is not a habitable place at all. But even the Earth, if you could get an equilibrium temperature on it with the albedo that we have, it's like 254 Kelvin. It's like quite cold. You're talking about almost 20 degrees Celsius below zero. So it's interesting that the types of things that get done here. And I also, it's a little pet gripe of mine. I don't know how you feel about it, Catherine, but the idea that, you know, oh, the habitable zone runs from Venus to Mars. It's like, come on, we can do better than that.
What's your gripe with that? I mean, that's just assuming different types of atmospheres, right? That's my understanding.
Yeah, but it's sort of like, you know, here we have the Goldilocks planet in the middle, which is the Earth. And then we've got Venus. Oh, that's not inhabitable. And Mars, that's not inhabitable either. So, you know, I feel like the limits might be potentially a little closer. I mean, you know, we could talk about this all day and icy moons and stuff. But you know, it's interesting, these things that sometimes we gloss over when we're talking to the public. And then this is, an example of how the public picks up on that and compounds, you know, the gloss a little bit.
Honestly, I just hate the whole concept of the habitable zone. Mm-hmm. The only thing it assumes is that there is liquid water on the surface of a planet. Like, that's the only thing you need for habitability. When I'm always harping on this, that you need more than just water for life, right? We're carbon-based creatures. If there's no carbon, you're not going to have life, right? And you know, you mentioned icy moons, right? Those are outside the habitable zone, but they've got liquid water in their subsurface, so they could also be habitable. So I honestly wish we just throw out this whole concept of a habitable zone, because it's really limiting and doesn't encompass the full spread of life we could find in the universe.
I'm with you there 100%. And speaking of things, so this is a thing I think that I don't blame the filmmakers for getting wrong. But the idea of campus being closed in the middle of the night, 100% on them. I mean, they're undergrad film students. Come on, they haven't been on campus at 3 a.m.
Yeah, no, I laughed at that when they're like, campus is closed, and there's like security guards monitoring the hallways. I mean, I'm sure there is like campus security, but they're not like wandering around the halls of campuses. I spent many a night in a computer lab at UBC in the middle of the night, and nobody cared. Basically, that's the great thing about universities in my mind. There's a freedom to movement and ideas and all of that. And so nobody would be like knocking on the door, kicking you out of an office in the middle of the night. They'd just be like, oh, those crazy astronomers up again looking at some weird star. that was a bit of a tension that was a bit unrealistic in the movie.
Definitely. And I think there's another one in there that frustrates me, I think. And it's a central conceit of the movie. So I understand it couldn't be changed because it was a requirement. But this idea that, you know, you've got Isaac who loses his access to the supercomputers for processing the data. Not that you typically need supercomputers to do that for exoplanets, but he decides to replace the supercomputers with an intern who has never done any science. And these are equivalent things. It's like, you know, oh, we got the intern, we're good now. It's like, these aren't interchangeable parts, I'm afraid. The kind of work that you do on a supercomputer is totally different than what you can give to even thousands of interns if you could, you know, have all those monkeys working on all those keyboards, you know, and so forth.
To be fair, humans are really good at pattern recognition. It would just be an extremely boring job, right? Going through spectrum after spectrum after spectrum, you know, looking for these dips in the light curve. Like, she would have lost her mind in about an hour. So speaking of which, when I was an undergrad, I worked at York University, where John is currently stationed, and my job was to count stars. So we were actually preparing for the Kepler mission. And so we wanted to make sure that the area it was looking at in the sky was not going to be contaminated by binary stars or really active stars that might, you know, mimic what a transit would look like. But what this meant in practice was that I had a software package identify stars in a Hubble image, but it was really bad at its job. So I then had to go through and like eliminate any things that were galaxies or noise. And so it was just mind-numbing work that I did for months. And I would not wish that on anyone. And that sort of sounds like what Clara was doing in this movie.
I was just taking a look around here while Catherine was talking, because I actually took over the office that you worked in. And so I have your nameplate from that summer.
Ah, my nameplate, just mm-hmm. like Isaac had in this movie. So it's very prominently displayed in one of the first scenes, Dr. Isaac Bruno. But it's funny because nobody has nameplates in academia. As I was telling John, I have like a piece of paper that's like stuck in, you know, next to my door in the hallway. That's the extent of it. I mean, I understand they use it as a narrative tool to very quickly tell us who this person is and, you know, what their job title is or whatnot. But it is extremely rare to see nameplates in academia. But apparently I still have a nameplate at York.
Well, not nameplates so much as, you know, again, you know, there's a little plate outside the door. And I think you and the other two students that were there that summer all had your names and something pithy. I think you were like, you know, expert star counter or something like that. I forget.
Well, that sounds about right. That sounds about right. Yeah, yeah. So I never want to see a Hubble image again.
So there's a few other things that I think gave me a little bit of trouble, partly because, you know, they're magical devices, right? And they're plot devices. So they start to talk as you get towards the second half of the movie, a little bit about quantum entanglement. And we've seen this before. We saw this with Ender's Game. And this idea of, you know, oh, you can have two different things at the atomic scale that if they're entangled and you pull them apart, you can send information faster than life. So that, I think, goes all the way back to the 60s in science fiction. And it's a trope that just, it won't die, unfortunately. But I kind of get why they want to do that. And they bring it in the very end of the movie to allow some communication between the civilization that, spoiler for those people who haven't seen it, Clara is a part of, or was a part of, and Isaac at the very end there. So that bothered me a little bit. And I also need to call out, I think, the technosignature thing a little bit, because for the first half of the movie, they are trying to find Earth 2.0. And they find Earth 2.0, but it's already been found. Damn. Can't save his career, unfortunately. Then he says, oh, well, we need to look for the things that are wrong instead of the things that are right. We need to look for megastructures. We need to look for things that are indicative of intelligent life, because he doesn't care about finding microbes and other life anymore. That's just, you know, pshaw, you know, we don't need that. And he comments in there that microbial life and other forms of, you know, basic life are not visible across interstellar distances. And I think here that even though there's still a lot of debate as to exactly what the biosignature gases are and what exactly constitutes, you know, some proof of life in another alien atmosphere, that, you know, it's still possible potentially to see those signals if we can interpret them. It's the interpretation, I think, that's the challenge here.
Sure, but they wouldn't be as convincing as the signature they end up finding of a giant space station orbiting just inside a planet. Although hilariously, they use the wrong transit to depict this space station, which John actually wrote a whole paper about.
That's right. This one is 100% entirely my fault. I have to admit. So here is where I come clean. And a lot of the work that I did, there were three science advisors who worked on Clara, and we all sort of specialized in different things. We all took a look at the script. We all took a look at the long cut of the film and made suggestions. But my specific task was working with the art department. So when you see transits in the film, they're typically transits that I simulated or created, and the art department added a whole bunch more dots on them to jazz them up a little bit. And the big pivotal discovery later in the movie, I did a simulation with a space station in orbit around a gas giant passing in front of a star. And I decided, being new at this game, that I would make this as realistic as I could. So we don't know what the disk of other stars looks like, but we do know what the sun looks like. So I went and I got a disk of the sun to create as accurate a transit as possible. And it just so happened, unfortunately, dear listener, that I had the spaceship and the planet pass across the disk of the sun, and it also passed across a sunspot. And a sunspot is naturally darker. So what happened is, as the space station and the shadow of the space station and the planet passed across the sunspot, the light came back up a little bit because the dark shadow was just blocking a darker spot instead of a bright piece of sun. And so you see a blip on there. And behind that blip, you can see the W-shaped signature of the actual space station. But the filmmakers took a look at that and said, oh, look at that blip. That's going to be so easy for the audience to understand. I'm like, but no, that's a sunspot. And they're like, no, we're going with the blip. So this is my fault. I take full responsibility for this one.
Well, they didn't listen to you either. So I've got to say, that whole ending, first of all, confused me and I hated it. But so the rest of the movie is a bit pretentious, but whatever, it was fine. But then they kind of really take a huge 180 at the end with this whole like alien civilization that comes about. And the very last scene, they actually get Morse code coming from this planet, which how in the world would aliens know that, right? I mean, Morse code was something humans invented. So I was like, is Clara an alien? And then which was not at all clear from the movie. So the whole ending was very confusing and very unsatisfying for me. John tells me that she was indeed supposed to be, what do you call it, a biological robot? But this was not at all clear and doesn't really jive with much of the rest of the movie. So I was really unsatisfied by this ending.
I can see that for sure. I mean, it was, I think those of us who worked on the production, by the time the film came out, this is something we already knew. So it seemed a little less jarring, but I can definitely see how that might not be obvious. So before we go into the science shine, is there anything else you really, you know, just are dying to put on the record, Catherine?
I do want to bring up one thing because I think we disagree about it. So I'd be curious to hear your take on this. So they make a big point in this movie about looking for planets around M-dwarfs. So M-dwarfs are the smallest main sequence stars, the smallest, you know, stars that could host a solar system. They're red and they're cool. And that means that the habitable zone should be quite close to the star. And so they're right in that makes it easier to find a transit because habitable worlds would be orbiting more frequently. And so you'd expect to see more transits over time. But I've always had a problem with this big push to look for habitable worlds around M-dwarfs, because the problem is any world in that zone will be pretty much tidally locked. So this is the same issue we have with the moon. So the moon, we only ever see one face of it. It's still rotating. It rotates every 28 days. It's just that rotational period is exactly the same as its orbital period. So that means you're only ever seeing the near side of the moon. We never see the far side of the moon. And this would happen with planets, habitable planets around an M-dwarf. And I've always wondered if that would actually make the planet habitable, since you're going to have crazy weather, right? If one side of the planet is constantly in sunlight and the other side is constantly in darkness, that just seems like a really tricky place to form life. So, but John, it seems like perhaps you're more optimistic about this scenario.
Yeah, so there's a few things I think going on here, and just so that our audience is aware. So when you're talking about stars that are are fusing hydrogen into helium. The three smallest classifications, you know, G-type star is what the sun is. Then you have Ks, and there's not a lot of those. But Ms, the smallest kind, there are lots of these things, and they are very long-lived. So you see a lot of them in the sky, and many of them have planets. But you've got to get, as Catherine says, pretty darn close, because they're not as bright as the sun in order to get into the, I have to say it, habitable zone of these places. So the question is, how do you avoid being tidally locked? And M dwarfs have other problems too, right? They've got trouble with, you know, enhanced UV in the spectrum. They've got trouble with flaring kinds of behavior. But there are those out there who feel that these might not be terrible places to be. You can get spin orbit resonances if you have eccentricity in the system. So if these are what a dynamicist would call hot systems. So an example of that in our own solar system is Mercury. So Mercury is in a spin orbit resonance, a 3-2. So it does have a day. It's not tidally locked in the sense of having the same face towards the sun all the time, but it's a very long day. It's 176 Earth days. It's twice actually as long as the Mercurian year is long. So there are apparently some dynamical solutions that can give you a not crazy day. And even if you are tidally locked, there are some who feel that the Terminator might not be a terrible place to live. Although definitely there are examples of exoplanets where the Terminator would be a horrible place to live. Places where you're vaporizing rock on one side and then snowing out that rock on the backside. Great place to visit, not a great place to live.
Yeah, it's a shame because, as you said, M dwarfs are so common. They probably have, you know, more planets than any other star, and they live forever. So it gives life a really long time to evolve. But personally, you know, if I were to be looking for Earth 2.0, I'd probably still want a G-type star like our own sun.
Definitely. And the situation that's presented in the movie, it just beggars the mind as to how it happened. This idea of, you know, oh, we've got this gas giant not in the habitable zone with the space station at L1 that is in the habitable zone. But if it's the space station, why does it need to be in the habitable zone? And where did these creatures come from in the first place? Because they didn't evolve in the space station, obviously. So more questions.
I didn't even think about that, but that's a great point.
All right. Well, we'll be back in just a minute for a little bit of Science Shine. All right, welcome back. So there are things that we liked about this movie. I feel like I say this every week, Catherine. Maybe it's just where we're starting with the gripes that I feel like I need to convince myself and the listener that, you know, this movie is not a total loss.
I think it's just in our nature as scientists to criticize things, even if we generally like it.
Oh, it's true. It's true. And there are some really, really nice things here and some nice little references. So Catherine already mentioned the main character, Isaac Bruno, which is a reference to well-known scientists, Isaac Newton and Giordano Bruno, even though entertainingly in the movie, apparently Isaac doesn't realize this and has to be told it by Clara. But there's other neat things as well. We could start right at the start and go back to the Drake equation, if you like.
Actually, before that, the very start of the movie, there is a quote before we ever see the characters, and it says, "Since 2009, the Kepler telescope has discovered more than 4,000 planets. Dozens of these exoplanets may be habitable." So even before we get into the meat of the movie, they're starting with a statement that is true. As we talked about, Kepler was a telescope that was looking for transits and searching for planets, and it has. It's discovered thousands of planets. That it really revolutionized the field of exoplanetary science. When John and I were undergrads, like, we knew of a handful of exoplanets. It was painstaking work to look for these exoplanets. And it wasn't until Kepler launched that, you know, the number of planets we discovered really exploded. And now we've got so many to study. And then regarding the second point, dozens of these exoplanets may be habitable. There's actually a group at the University of Puerto Rico that puts together a catalog of what they think the most likely habitable worlds to be. And I looked at it a few days ago, and they have 29 potentially habitable worlds on that list as of January of 2024. So it does seem reasonable that dozens of these exoplanets could be habitable, at least as we talked about with regard to the habitable zone.
Yeah, I think one thing that was nice that I should comment on is that I feel like the filmmakers tried here. Like, you know, the science advisors that were on board were not there, you know, as a token or as, you know, some kind of, you know, like here we brought a few people on that we didn't listen to. I feel like generally speaking, we were listened to, and they did try to involve us. So I think you're seeing a bit of that here as well, where we've been able, especially in scenes that don't have a big important part to play in the plot, that we're able to do like some of the little things, like you say, with this this quote here at the beginning, and, you know, a few other little bits and pieces.
Yeah, no, I, in general, I thought the science was well done. So congratulations, John. classroom scene, you know, even like the very first thing you see, it was an equation, and I looked it up, and it's the magnetic dipole radiation from a pulsar, which just seems like a very specific thing to do. But I believe he was talking maybe about planets around pulsars. So there's a lot of details there. Then you talked about the Drake equation comes up again. He describes that in some detail correctly. So this is the idea that you can kind of quantify the number of worlds in the galaxy that might be able to communicate with us. And you can plug in some numbers and get a reasonable value. And so he says it gives us every reason to believe that life should be common in our galaxy. You can debate that. You know, the numbers in this equation are pretty ill-constrained, but it's not zero, probably. So that's good. They also talk about the Fermi paradox, which is another important concept in astronomy. I think this was developed by famous physicist Enrico Fermi, who wondered, if life is common, as the Drake equation might imply, why hasn't it contacted us, right? Why aren't we talking to these aliens if they're out there?
And I love the reasons for that. This is the playground of science fiction. One of my favorites is the zoo hypothesis. Have you heard of that one?
I think so, but go ahead and describe it.
So the idea is that either these new creatures that evolve are either, you know, so dangerous in their adolescent stage that they need to be isolated from the rest of the galaxy, or they need to be allowed to develop on their own, and they need to be kept alone. So everyone is told, you know, don't talk to these people, and they're kept separate. So the idea that, you know, you're kept in a zoo a little bit by the interstellar civilization that exists out there, you know, like from the movie Contact.
Right. Or in Star Trek, famously, the Vulcans only make contact with Earth when they detect a warp signature. They're not going to bother with them if they haven't developed that far. Apparently, we're also really smelly to Vulcans, so maybe they just didn't want to deal with that.
Could be like Klingons with tribbles.
So, you know, maybe they just don't want to bother with these unadvanced civilizations. Wait until we've evolved a little bit more, and then maybe they'll want to talk to us.
Indeed, indeed. And I think they do a pretty good job with the spacecraft as well. Like, TESS is a real spacecraft. JWST is a real spacecraft. With TESS, the way that they talk about it in terms of the number of planets that had planned to go and observe, that's actually an accurate statistic there. They say hundreds of thousands, and it focuses on 200,000, mainly looking for stuff nearby, which does actually mean a lot of those M-dwarfs, of course. So it lines up actually pretty darn well. Now I will admit I did laugh when I saw, you know, their version of the NASA logo. I guess they couldn't license that. And they do change the name of the PI of that particular project as well. I'm guessing also for similar reasons. But by and large, they get these pretty right.
Right, right. Although I laughed at how optimistic they were being about the JWST launch. It was famously delayed. So this movie came out in 2018. They're like, oh, it's launching next year. And JWST has been delayed at this point by about a decade. And everyone just kept waiting for it to launch. It eventually launched on Christmas Day in 2021. So it was just a few years later, but it cost billions of dollars and was way over schedule. But, you know, now that we're actually getting data back from it, It's pretty cool, I got to admit. So, however, it's so cool that everybody wants to use it. And so this idea that if they just could find a promising star system to analyze, they could immediately get JWST data to characterize its atmosphere is a bit ludicrous. I looked up the stats from the last proposal round, and they had an oversubscription rate of 9-1. So the chances of getting JWST data for your planet of interest are next to nothing. But if you can, then you are able to characterize an atmosphere in some cases and learn more about whether it's habitable.
There's something that I just remembered, actually. I've served on these telescope allocation committees. I think you might have as well, Catherine.
Yep.
And they do retain a little bit of time for things that just happen in the middle of a cycle, if it's exciting enough.
I'm not sure this would qualify.
it's true. Unless, you know, this, like, I could imagine the follow-up, right? Like after the PI of Tess is like, oh goodness, right? Then maybe, but yeah, before that, not so much.
Yeah. Anyways, I that was not super realistic to me. However, what was realistic is the fact that this guy in his apartment in Toronto could just download the data and work on it without having any official position at any university. I don't think a lot of people appreciate this, but all NASA data is eventually public since it's taxpayer funded. Sometimes there's an embargo period during which time only the scientists involved with the mission can work with it, so they can get, you know, publish any exciting first discoveries. But eventually, you know, whether it's weeks or months or years, that data will be released and anyone can work with it. And I looked it up, and in the case of TESS, that data was public only 41 days after the first light image was taken. So, you know, it seems realistic that he could have been working on this data with his intern and possibly making discoveries.
It's possible. It's a question of, and I haven't looked at this myself, so you may know more than me on this, Catherine, but there's also this interesting thing that happens with images on these missions, at least on our solar system missions. So I know there's people out there who look at what comes down from Perseverance, what comes down from Curiosity every single day. And we do put out the images, you know, within seconds of hitting Goldstone. Like they're out there, they're on the web, but they're not calibrated and they're not provided with the entire dynamic range of the data. So as a researcher, those images are not actually useful to me. But it's possible that the tests actually eliminated the embargo period. And this is something that's really interesting, because you think about Kepler, for instance. Kepler had and asked for a longer than usual embargo period. And this was very controversial at the time. So typically spacecraft, people who operate spacecraft will get a little bit of time with the data themselves before it goes out to the public. And it's the same thing often with these telescopes. So if you ask for data on Hubble or JWST, what will typically happen is you'll get that data first. And then if you don't publish in a certain amount of time, then it becomes part of the public record and anybody can publish on it. So that's a question, since these are all government-funded things. Do people actually deserve that kind of time? So it's an interesting question that's being debated in sort of the channels. I think folks in universities, we look at the investment that you have to make in terms of time and effort to get one of these things run. And we really appreciate the embargo that you get, the time that you get with the data by yourself. But in my time in government, the thought was, you know, this is public data. This is paid for by the taxpayer. It should be available immediately. So there's this tension there. I don't know if you've run into it.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. But overall, I think science is better with lots of eyes looking at it, lots of minds thinking about it. So, and there's so many questions to study. It's really rare to get scooped. Everyone's approaching a question or a topic from a different perspective. And so I want to hear all those ideas. So, you know, I'm not that concerned with a short embargo period, personally.
I'm with you there. And speaking of educating people, I'm always impressed, you know, with this movie, how they take the time to sit down and instruct Clara, but really the viewer, as to how a transit works. So there's some drawings on napkins in a coffee shop that are actually pretty good.
Yeah. Although I was impressed that he was drawing right on the table. I guess it had some paper on top or something. But yeah, it was a pretty good illustration of what a transit looks like. He drew a star and a little planet going in front of it, and then what the transit curve looks like. And then he gives a paper to Clara, and he's like, "Where's the transit?" And she's like, "There." this very obvious dip. And he's like, yeah. So they're, yeah, like you're saying, they're instructing the viewer on what a transit looks like. Because as you say, and I guess you made these, there's tons of transit pictures throughout the rest of the movie. And so you kind of have to know what you're looking for there. Not as noisy, perhaps, as real transits. They simplified it a little bit, but certainly a good explanation.
Oh, definitely. And I think this is a movie when brings in these transits are almost a main character, or at least a major device. And there is discussion of the sorts of things that can make this noisy, you know, having a telescope that, you know, is not very big, you know, gives you more noise, you know, you get more noise, or you can get other things that obscure what's really going on and make it hard to see things like, you know, that W shape of the space station, or even exomoons, which I think they comment on. Which again, oh goodness, you know, the blip is many things, but it's not that either.
Yeah, although I think it's fun that they bring up the concept of exomoons. Mm-hmm. So these would be, you know, moons that orbit a giant planet, just like Europa and Titan orbit Jupiter and Saturn. And, you know, theoretically, you should be able to detect these. They should alter the transit light curve a little bit. But since they're so small, my understanding is they are very hard to detect. So we've never confirmed the existence of an exomoon. They're almost certainly out there. I think there are maybe a few candidates, though. So stay tuned there. You know, I think that might be an exciting new discovery that comes out in the next few years. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened.
Yeah, that would be really neat. The challenge is that these mostly show up on the light curves on the edges, where it's the hardest place to find them.
Yeah. But that would be very cool to learn of the existence of an exomoon, because they must be out there. Look at our giant planets. They've got hundreds of moons, right?
Absolutely. So anything else you want to mention here?
No, other than I thought it was kind of funny that they were like looking at this star they were studying from their very light polluted apartment in Toronto. It's not technically impossible to do that, but I don't know how realistic that was.
Well, I will tell you that, so this is, I think, outside of the episode, but the 16-inch that we've got upstairs, we do exoplanetary transit observations with it all the time. And light pollution is a problem, but that's the learning experience for the students to be able to pull that out.
All right. Well, maybe that is realistic then, that they could look at their planet from their apartment in Toronto.
All right. Well, let's move on now from the science shine and talk a little bit of the section of the program that's of its time. So we'll be right back in just a minute. So I think this is one of the most modern pieces that we've done. This one is from technically released in 2018. Of course, movies and TV take a little bit of time to come out. So this might seem a little bit strange that we're talking about, you know, something of its time that is 7 years old. But I think there's a few things that took us back to other things. And then there were some bits and pieces in there that, you know, just seemed a little bit strange. Maybe not so much of its time, but of no time at all. So let's jump in. What's your favorite bit here?
Okay. The thing that bothered me throughout this whole movie was, how the heck was Isaac supporting himself, his new friend, and her dog in Toronto in a 2-bedroom apartment with no job? It just distracted me for the whole movie. Toronto is an extremely expensive place to live, and they never explain this. The only thing I could think of is maybe he wasn't fired. Maybe he was just put on leave and they were still paying him. But like I said, I found that very distracting part of the movie.
That's true. Even on full salary, that would be a bit of a stretch, I think.
Maybe he comes for money. I don't know. It's never explained how the heck they're surviving in Toronto.
It's true, although that is pretty common, isn't it, in movies and TV, that often people are living in apartments and, you know, houses that are technically beyond their means of, you know, whatever job it is they're doing.
Right. Famously, I think Friends always gets picked on for that. Monica and Rachel living in this enormous apartment with a waitress job.
Yeah, that's right. I think the other one that often comes up is Sex and the City, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Carrie Bradshaw mm-hmm. has a pretty nice apartment. I think they try to explain it with some sort of rent control in that situation, but still, yeah.
So, of course, I enjoy my undergrad at Ontario University. That was a lot of fun. It's pretty good as fake logos for fake schools go, I have to say.
It did remind me a lot of the logo for the University of Toronto, though. And I did appreciate that they had a Department of Astrophysics, because my understanding that U of T is one of the very few universities that has a department just of astronomy and astrophysics. Most universities have a Department of Physics and Astronomy, but for whatever reason, U of T has only this astrophysics department. So I think they were really trying to play on all this.
So aside from that, there's a comment that, and I guess Catherine and I are sensitive to this being elder millennials ourselves, but there's this, you know, like, oh, millennials. And it's kind of a strange comment to make. I mean, this is a movie written by somebody who's Gen Z, who I don't know if maybe I'm just not hearing it right, because they're not telling me if, you know, they're complaining about millennials. The classic complaint is, you know, I guess from older generations about millennials. And Isaac actually is the same age as me and Catherine. So he too is in that elder millennial kind of bucket. So it's kind of weird that, you know, he's there complaining about these students. Plus, it's 2018. He's not teaching millennials anymore.
Yeah, I feel like this is a trope that kind of got introduced maybe, I don't know, 20 years ago, where they just used the word millennial to complain about young people and they just never updated their language. So now millennial is just any young person who's a layabout, even though we're now in our 40s, you know, or late 30s for the most part, with jobs and mortgages and kids. So, and a very hardworking generation, I will say. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a weird comment to make to his friend, I thought.
And I know that Catherine, when you were watching this movie, you just had stars in your eyes. You just totally fell in love with Isaac.
Oh, my gosh. John's being sarcastic. I found him to be an extremely unlikable character, which is one of the reasons I didn't like the movie much. He just doesn't have a lot of redeeming qualities. He's selfish. He's self-absorbed. He never looks like he's having any fun. He's always kind of just moping about, obsessive about this search for exoplanets. So it was really hard to connect to the movie when I didn't even like the character, the main character.
It's a challenge. Now, you know, some of the little mannerisms that he does, I find interesting, because I worked a fair bit with one of the other science advisors who's senior to me, not a millennial himself. And Patrick J. Adams actually copied a number of those little quirks. So I found that interesting. But in terms of the overall arc of the character, and I think this is the way it's written, it's not so much the way it's acted. This was where the main reviews that happened of the movie after it came out at TIFF, this is what they really homed into. The idea that Clara in particular, the title character, seems to exist only to bring Isaac back to caring about the world and liking his life and to build up his character again. And that is a common trope that you'd find. It's called the manic pixie dream girl trope. And you find it in other examples as well. Oddly, the main example that's often given of this is another science fiction movie also shot in Toronto, Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I don't know if I've seen that one. Yeah, but it's a real shame, because I thought Clara was a much more interesting character, more likable, but they didn't really try to develop her into a fully formed three-dimensional person. I think you're right. She was just there as like kind of a plot device to move Isaac's story along.
There's a few gestures towards a history, but not really. Not enough to flesh that person out in three dimensions, like you say.
Yeah, her magical rocks, for example.
Gotta have magical rocks. Come on.
Yeah, one of which was a meteorite from Antarctica, which I didn't quite understand since it's nobody goes to Antarctica for the most part. And the ones who do go there to pick up meteorites don't just hang on to them. They turn them over for scientific analysis. So I'm not sure where this person got a meteorite from Antarctica.
Hey, maybe she put one in her pocket and didn't tell anybody.
Well, no, she's never even been to Antarctica. She said she got it from like an Icelandic fisherman or something. So how did he get it?
Got to be careful of those black market meteorites.
That's right. I do want to mention one other thing too, which I don't think John will mention himself, but there's a fun little Easter egg right at the beginning where Isaac is wandering through the hallways of Ontario University and looks up to see these pictures of notable alumni. And really he's staring at a picture of his ex-wife, but right next to it is very clearly a picture of John. So if you want to see what John looks like, watch the first few scenes of this movie, and he's stationed there as a notable alumni of Ontario University.
Yes, that's entirely right. I'm the one on the right, not the one on the left. And after the film finished shooting, the art department, as a thank you, gave me the original plot, the original prop. And for a while, the students decided to hang it up in the lab, but I thought that was too creepy. So now it lives behind my cabinet.
It's just hidden from the world now.
It is. I actually, you know, maybe after we finish recording, I'll dig it out.
Okay, very good. Very good. Although, in general, I thought the production values of this movie were pretty good. The locations were very, very nice. I mean, there's some beautiful campuses in Toronto. It sounds like we said the University of Toronto at Mississauga was featured here. Also, the filmmaker's alma mater, which used to be called Ryerson. Now it's called
Toronto Metropolitan.
Thank you. I always get it wrong. So yeah, there's some really great set pieces, you know, strolls along Lake Ontario. So the setting I thought was pretty nice overall.
I'd agree with you there. It does look very university-y, which is, mm-hmm. you know, what you're kind of going for. I mean, you talked about when we were talking about the X-Files, the use of Vancouver as a filming city. And there's still a lot of stuff filmed at Vancouver, but there's been a big influx in the last, you know, 15 years, I'd say, into Toronto as a destination to shoot things as well. So now we're starting to see a little bit more use here. Though I do remember, I think there were scenes from Good Will Hunting back in the 90s that were filmed at U of T because of the old ivy kind of architecture in places.
Yeah. I wanted to ask if you knew what happened to that giant mural that Clara paints. In one scene, she's painting this giant mural on a wall of the University of the Helix Nebula. Was that what it was?
That's right.
It's gorgeous. Do you know what ever happened to that?
I do not, unfortunately. I have no idea. So the Helix Nebula, by the way, has the nickname the Eye of God. So I think that's why they chose that particular one. Essentially, it's a star that's puffed off all of its outer layers as it died and became a white dwarf. Yeah, that would be pretty. I bet there's somebody who kept that for themselves.
It's too bad. Yeah. It would look really nice in, you know, in the hallway of a university somewhere.
Oh, it was gorgeous. Also, in terms of set locations, the Caltech control room, I believe that is the GO Transit Center. So they had created a new hub that wasn't open yet to manage all of the GO Transit traffic in Toronto. And so the filmmakers actually got the opportunity to use that facility right before it opened, you know, with all the computers and the big screens and whatnot.
Okay, they fooled me. I mean, it looked realistic enough for a kind of a control room at a university.
All right. Well, the last part of this is where we go ahead and we rate things. So we'll be right back in a minute with that.
All right, welcome back. So here we're going to rate the movie on three things: its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how does it hold up? We're using a scale of 1 to 5 to rank each of these. John, I know you're biased, but how would you rank the science accuracy of this film?
Oh, goodness, it's obviously a 6 on a scale of 5. Come on. No, actually, I give this one about a 4.5. I think there are some things in here. And it's interesting watching it again after not having seen it for the better part of a decade. There are, I think, a few more things that irk me. So I can't give it the full 5, but it tries. And unlike the core, it mostly succeeds.
I gave it a 4, a little bit lower than John. Overall, I thought the science was pretty good. As we talked about, you know, there's some realistic elements with regards to the telescopes and the transits, but they really leaned into this sort of pseudoscience aspect near the end, which really bothered me. At one point in the movie, Clara tells Isaac just to like look at a map of stars and point at one, and that's the one he's going to study. And so I didn't like the whole astronomy through vibes kind of approach they were taking. So that turned me off a little bit. All right. How about its influence? How much has this influenced society, you, the world? What would you rank that, John?
So this one, I would rank 1 out of 5. I don't feel the need to, you know, push the scale down to 0 or anything like that. This is a film that came out. It was a small independent Canadian film. It came out in 2018. It premiered at TIFF. It was a great night to have. The reviews were middling. It didn't come out in the box office. So I don't think this had a strong effect on anyone that I'm aware of within the community or even in the, you know, in the wider public.
I also gave it a 1. I had never heard of it. I never would have watched it if John hadn't told me about it. And really the movie, I don't know, really to me seemed like somebody's film school project. And it turns out the writer and director was actually dropped out of film school in order to make this movie. So it just didn't have the sort of maturity and that I was looking for in a movie. And I just don't think a lot of people have seen this, or I probably wouldn't recommend it either. Sorry, John.
No, I understand that. I understand that.
Okay. As John mentioned, this isn't a very old movie, but, you know, how does it hold up in the past 7 years, would you say?
So I'd give it a 3, I think, out of 5. So middle of the road towards a little bit more. It doesn't feel like it's dated, even though it's pre-pandemic. It doesn't feel like it's particularly dated to me. But I think there's enough there that seems like it's not really even of that time, you know, the little bit of strangeness that I think we talked about. So that's enough for me to knock it down to something more average.
I gave it a 2, but I think that just goes back to the fact that I thought the movie was a bit pretentious and kind of amateurish in some regards. Not regard with the production values. I did like those, but just in terms of the message it was trying to send, it just didn't resonate with me. So I couldn't give it very high marks there. And anything else you want to add before we wrap things up, John?
No, I think that's a pretty good walk around Clara. So until the next time that you listen to us here on Popcorn Science, go out, see something interesting, even go ahead and take a look at Clara. And frankly, I wish I could see your face when you see it. Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.